I was given very precise details as to what I ought to discuss with you by the person who asked me to come. And it really is the basis of a course which I give to theological students in both Bristol and in Paris, and it normally takes a whole week. However, she said I could cope. It's whether you can cope is the question. Well, we'll see what we can do. And the first topic I was given was to look at the subject of depression, particularly from the point of view of trying to decide, is this a depression which really requires medical care, or is it somebody who requires a different kind of care? And in any case, can you separate depression in that sort of way? And by what criteria do you do so? And the first thing I want to do is just say a few words about depression itself. It's a debased word. The experience of depression is profound, deep, and scarring in many, therapeutic in some. But the word itself is used to communicate anything from boredom on the one hand to profound suicidal thoughts. But some years ago, a theological student came and worked in the unit where I work in Bristol. It was part of his practical theology placement, or he chose it anyway as part of his placement, and he worked for 10 weeks during the summer as a nursing auxiliary in an acute psychiatric ward. And then he had to write up his experiences subsequently. He had in fact been a banker or something like that beforehand, then gone to theological college. So he was a person who had knocked around in the world and met people in the past. And he wrote this, that he found it quite disturbing to find how normal most of the people on the ward were. And there are very few places that I can go to in Bristol without meeting some of my ex-patients going about their ordinary business or their leisure activities one way or another. The vast majority of people who have even quite severe depression requiring admission to hospital go back into the community to cope with their ordinary, everyday lives and continue to do well. In fact, 50% of people who have a severe depression will not have a subsequent depression. And that's a pretty good prognosis when you think of most of the things that you have if you have to get under the surgeon's knife or even into the physician's bed. You just think of it. Bronchitis, diabetes, hernias, varicose veins, ulcers and so on. 50% will never have another severe depression. However, of the other 50%, there will be recurrent illnesses, but these may be spaced by many years. And one patient I remember I saw when she was 76 with an acute agitated depression. Her previous illness was at the age of 16, when she had a spell of something like a year in psychiatric hospital following a broken love affair. At least that's what it was put down to in those days. 60 years in between, and she did not have a severe illness during that time. So we have to get things into perspective, even when we're dealing with the most severe conditions. Those, however, who may try your patience and your pastoral skills are those who perhaps have repeated admissions, who are severe manic depressives, and we may refer to that later, or those who have much more of a personality problem woven into their experience of depression. Now, the second thing which this man said was, it was only when he began to open up some of his more dogmatically defended ideals and became vulnerable, in other words, began to see not psychiatric patients as in one category and well people in another category, but to see how any of us under certain circumstances could become depressed, and then look at the complexity of people's lives in association with that, that he began to feel that he was making some headway, but at the same time felt extremely vulnerable in doing so. Am I any different from they are? Are not the circumstances which have made them collapse in life similar to the circumstances which have afflicted me? All right, let's put up a pretty picture for you. Could somebody switch on the... Splendid. There's the sort of diagram, I would suggest, which presents itself to you. Can you all see? Well, there's not much I can do about that. Well, there you are. There's somebody offering help on my left, and somebody saying, I want some help on my right. And there's a complex interaction in the meeting of two people in that sort of way. Because the person who is offering help is having to ask. Now, this person, and let's just take depression as being the commodity that is being discussed. This person who says he's depressed, is this a person who's ill, and that's a bed with a patient in it, in other words, with his nose turned up and his toes turned up. You know, there is someone who is ill. Is this an illness? Or is this someone whose depression basically is the way he sees things? In other words, an attitude of mind. And that's a brain, or meant to be, beside it. Or is this someone who, when he says, or when she says, I am depressed, what they're really talking about is a particular kind of situation, or a particular type of grouping, whether it's within a family, whether it's within work, whether it's within the church. That here the person is acting out a role. In some situations they certainly become depressed, in other situations they're the life and soul of the party, and you wouldn't know it was the same person. Or lastly, the question mark indicates, is this a person who is depressed? And really what they're doing is saying, I cannot see what the point of my life is, or what life is about. If you like, a loss of meaning.
I think this could, where he's become...
Do you want to have a go? Some of you get a crick in your neck there, but... Now, on the other side of that particular encounter, you're also looking at a question... Hands on the side, ignore. Is this a person who really needs a doctor? My fees are rather high, Sandy. I'm afraid I can't oblige. Does he need a doctor, or is it someone who requires a counsellor? And I've been rather sexist here and put in the lady with a cup of tea, saying, there, my love, aren't men awful, aren't they dreadful, and so on. Golly, I must get the tea on before my man comes home. On the one hand, to the professional social worker, counsellor, and so on. It's the whole gamut of counselling that I include there. Or is it someone who really needs someone to care? And that's a different kind of intervention, which I'll come back to later. That's Parson with his halo. But it can be anybody who sees a sense of belonging as part of what is going on. Now there you are. There's the kind of scenario which one has. You can have as many other bits to it as you like, but I think that's enough to be getting on with. Now let's change. There in the first column, I have taken the first model, as it were, of depression. If you like, here is the organic model. In other words, this is a way of looking at depression which says there are physical factors associated with this person's depression. In other words, this is an illness. And any illness has signs and symptoms. That is, the things which you can observe and the things which the patient may recount to you. And I put this one first because many ministers, in my experience, and many other people who are in a sort of caring situation, spend an inordinate amount of time discussing problems, issues, with a person where a few well-chosen questions would indicate that perhaps here is someone who, whatever else he needs, requires also to visit his GP. And if you take nothing else away from this morning, apart from what I'm going to say in the next few minutes, I think you will have saved yourself a lot of time and frustration and probably done an enormous service to the person you're trying to help. What are the symptoms and signs then of illness kind of depression? And they are things like poor sleep. But the characteristic of the sleep disturbance which would indicate that a doctor should be involved is a change in the sleep pattern, and I've emphasized that, a change in the sleep pattern where a person who normally slept well or reasonably well or had a pattern which was established in his sleep begins to waken up earlier in the morning, and that this becomes a new established pattern. I mean, merely waking up early when you've got something rather unpleasant to face that day is not counted. But when that goes on day after day, week after week, that someone who went through to 7 o'clock or whatever it was begins to waken up at 6, 5, 4 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and some may even say 2 o'clock, and then not get back to sleep again. That's a fair indication that there is something rather more clinical and medical possibly going on. So sleep disturbance. The loss of appetite and loss of weight rather than the overeating. Some patients who are depressed, overeat is a comforting phenomenon. But where a person loses weight and is not eating, then again, one has a symptom which, or a feature which makes us feel perhaps this is something which is more medical. And the etc. includes things like a difference in the way in which one feels during the day. Most of us, you know, run out of steam as the day goes on. Others of us may, in fact, feel the mornings rather bad and we sort of warm up after we've got ourselves together by midday. There are the owls and the larks of this world. But it's the person who wakes up early in the morning with a sense of gnawing, agitation, stomach turning over, apprehension, terror perhaps, even panic. It's that feeling worse in the morning, that kind of morbid rumination, first thing in the morning, which improves as the day goes on. Or that extreme slowness in the morning, which is not one's usual wont, which then seems to alleviate as the day goes on, which we call in our lingo diurnal variation of mood. In other words, the mood improves as the day goes on, rather than as running out of steam. Now that along with early waking, that along with loss of weight, and that along with morbid preoccupation would indicate you say to the person, go and see your GP. Now what do I mean by morbid preoccupation? I mean that kind of looking at life where everything seems gloomy, grey, and rather pessimistic. Where, in a sense, you put on grey-coloured spectacles and everything you look at in life is tinted by them. Now, some patients may persuade you into that way of thinking. They'll tell you of all the awful things in their lives. And, of course, one of the temptations of young psychiatrists is when a patient comes and says, yes, my mother died, and then this happened, and something else happened, and so on and so forth. And the poor young psychiatrist says, golly, if all that happened to me, I'd feel exactly the same as they do. So you might. But that doesn't take away the fact that this person may be depressed in a clinical way in relation to those situations. So don't be persuaded by what we call the reasoning depression into saying, well, that's life, isn't it? It's as bad as that. You've every right to be depressed. Bye-bye. And unfortunately, that's one of the things that one has to take most young psychiatrists through as they do their training. So they look for the features. And it's this morbid preoccupation which sometimes can make the person feel that even death and suicide would be justified. And of course we have the example of William Cowper, the hymn writer, who spoke of how he was rescued from suicide And so morbid was his thinking that he said man had disavowed him, God had nothing to do with him, and even hell had bolted its ever-hungry jaws against him as he'd been rescued from suicide. And there are Christians who can feel, yes, my situation is so awful that there is only one way out. Many other Christians would say, no, I'd never do a thing like that. But that wouldn't stop them thinking that way. And if there is that kind of morbid preoccupation with suicidal thoughts, then you should pay attention to it. Because, in fact, most people who kill themselves have given fair warning that that is how they felt. It is not true that people who say, I'm going to kill myself, don't, and those who don't say it are the more likely to do so. People give fair warning, often with the very tablets which have been given to them by the doctor when they've gone to the doctor and said, I feel depressed. And that's been the only response which they've had. So those are the signs and symptoms. Now, it doesn't take much to ask a question about sleep of that sort. Doesn't take much to ask a question about any time of day they feel worse. It doesn't take much to say, how bad does this depression get? And why does it seem so bad at those times? That doesn't make you into a psychiatrist. It just means that you're a minister who's got a few more questions up his sleeve to ask. And there's nothing wrong in that. When it comes then to causation, if there's been a family history of depression, such people are more likely to become depressed. It's not an all or nothing thing, but there is no doubt that there is a predisposition to depression in people whose parents or brothers and sisters have had a severe depression as well. A previous history we should always ask for, even if they weren't in hospital, again giving an indication that here is someone perhaps with a constitutional loading in that direction. Physical things such as influenza, glandular fever, hepatitis, long before ME and all that goes with it was discussed, one taught that after every flu epidemic there would be an epidemic of depression too. And it's not that the flu or the viral infection causes the depression, as far as I'm concerned, but it's that final assault upon somebody who was perhaps just coping with life, which is the last straw. There is a post-viral fatigue, and those of you who've had flu or glandular fever or something like that will know how perhaps for some weeks afterwards you really feel you're, it takes great effort to struggle through the sort of lethargy which follows it. Now, if a person's already under pressure, that may be the last thing. So some physical factor like that may also produce a depression. Life events, so jargon phrase for the things that happen to us in life. And all of us will be subjected to events in life which will cause us pain and joy, but even the things which cause us joy have a stress factor built into them. Here is just the charge you've been waiting for. It's really going to be the place where God is going to bless you and use all your gifts and so on. You and the people have found each other. And the congregation have been saying, we've been looking for you, and you saying, yes, and I've been praying for you. And you meet. But in that very adjustment from one community to another, in that moving from one house to another, there are stress factors built in. And if it happens to coincide with the loss of one of one's parents in another part of the country, or the birth of a new baby, or some other complication like that, then you begin to pile up what we call life events. It used to be said, once you got to a certain score, then you toppled over the edge. It's not as simple as that. And people used to give sophisticated scores, so much for having a baby, so much for changing a job, and so on. I made a point, but it's not quite like that. Because the point that I really want to get over here is, it's the closeness in time of these time events, these life events, which may be more important. If you've got nice 2 years in between each major event, you can come to terms with things. There's an adjustment factor built in there. If, in fact, you get three events within 1 year, you have no time to get going on one situation before another comes, and then another comes. And you begin to sag at the knees, and then you get influenza, and down you go. So, it doesn't mean that the person's weak because they respond in this way. It means that the human organism has perhaps had more than it can reasonably cope with at that moment in time. And secondly, the life event may have very specific significance for an individual. Moving from a community where there's lots of support may be far more traumatic for somebody who in fact has never ever lived away from having granny figures around and so on, and then going to a community where there's no support, where people don't see support built in that way, may be quite damaging. And I think of some individuals for whom, you know, the house is their most important security, many of the people that you'll be dealing with. Here they've got their dream home. But husband has got his dream job, which is 200 miles away. Actually in England or some place like that. How awful. And not only is there a new culture that they've got to get used to, but they lose their dream home, and they can't afford quite the same home as they had in Scotland, but he knows that he's not going to get on in his job unless he goes and plunders the English for a while in order to get back again. And what is built in? An unhappy, distressed wife, whose mother then becomes ill, and then his job is no longer the positive thing which it was. So it may be the significance as well of the particular loss, the particular change to the individual concerned. And you can't just clock that up and give it a figure. So these are the sort of things which may produce a depression. It's the sort of things one should be looking for. And I'm quite happy to give a diagnosis to that and say, here's a person who has a clinical depression, and to give appropriate treatment, which would be antidepressants, even ECT, that's electroconvulsive therapy. And those patients who are profoundly depressed undoubtedly do well with electroconvulsive therapy. But no physical treatment cures depression. There is no cure for this kind of depression. What the treatment does is alleviates the suffering, enables the person to function at a better level, in order that the healing processes within the person themselves can begin to operate. I use the analogy of if you break your leg, you can lie up, immobilize that leg, and it will heal. And there's nothing you can do to make that leg heal quicker than the ordinary bone structures and so on will do themselves. But while you're waiting the 6 weeks for the healing to take place, what happens is your muscles atrophy, life goes on, and in fact you may be worse off at the end of the day than you started in certain areas. So you put a plaster of Paris round, it's not very comfortable, it has all sorts of side effects, it doesn't cure the broken leg, but it enables you to hobble around and get on with life while the healing is going on. Now an antidepressant and an ECT function in that sort of way. Give Valium, of course, to such a patient and you are actually storing up trouble, because it gives immediate relief of tension, which then passes off and the person easily becomes habituated to it, in addition to perhaps feeling the depression is getting worse. There you are. That's it at a medical line. That's not something which you treat. It's something which you can actually inquire about, and it's something which you can say to the individual, look, I think you ought to go and chat to your GP. That doesn't mean that you rub them off your slate and say, nothing to do with me from now on. But if that is going on, the chances of you being able to do very much significant work while they're profoundly depressed and needing that kind of help is much less. But having said that, patients do get better from depression. It may take them a couple of years. But how much better that they have appropriate medical treatment while they're improving from their depression. Now, can you slip the sheet of paper over one slot? Thank you. Now, here is the next way of looking at it. And we call this the intrapsychic model, if you like. In other words, what is going on inside the person's mind, their attitude to life itself and to themselves and to the life events which happen. The sort of technical phrase we have here is psychodynamics, That means the powers within our mental functioning. Jim Phillip was talking earlier of the sort of person who is rather pessimistic in life, who turns things against themselves and who says, oh dear, 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 I'm no good, etc. Who will always take things in a negative way to themselves, as opposed to those who will take things in a different way. When things go wrong, they say, it's their fault. I and the Lord are agreed on this, and they are all wrong. On the other hand, maybe I'm a failure, maybe I shouldn't be in the ministry, maybe I shouldn't be caring for people, maybe I'm a rotten husband, and so on. But I'm rotten at everything anyway, aren't I? Now that's an extreme case, but it is the kind of person who interjects all the problems, as opposed to the person who projects them all. It's all your fault. So if you find yourself habitually saying, who has taken my this, that, or the next thing? Who has misplaced my so-and-so? Then you're certainly training yourself to be the kind of person who blames other people for everything. When you say, oh, I must be dementing, I can't remember where I put everything, then you're more likely to be the other kind of person. It used to be that men were the great projectors on other people, and women, it's all my fault. Society is changing. And I see, when I talk to medical students with this sort of thing, it's now 50-50. So there you are, the feminist movement is making its point. So, psychodynamics, what are the factors behind this? I just briefly deal with these. Early experiences, loss experiences, learning experiences in childhood. Very often these very pessimistic people who have a low self-esteem, who tend to see things in pessimistic ways, who become rather perfectionist in their approach to life, are people who've got a parent, at least one parent, who was, at best, a non-approver, at worst, a disapprover. You're not the kind of daughter we wanted. Or we always wanted a son, and we got you instead. Ha ha. But what does that do? Or, you know, I nearly died having you. And I always ask only children, why are you an only child? Oh, I never asked. You mean you never asked why you didn't have a brother or sister? Oh, well, there was something about my mother nearly died when I was being born. And that's the message that's passed over. How obliged you are then to give all the goodies that parents demand thereafter. And sometimes the only way one can get out of that is by cutting and running, but we'll come on to that in the next session, in the next term section. The point here is that some people, for one reason or other, which we don't fully understand, but which does seem to be in part associated with upbringing and attitudes inculcated in childhood, are rather pessimistic, rather low, become easily discouraged and depressed. And their response to this sort of thing is to take an all-or-nothing approach to life. They either say, I am no good, therefore I will not tackle anything, so I'll never be proven to be no good. It's better not to do something than to do something and fail. So they're the nothings. Then the others who say, I know I've got abilities, I will show them, I'll prove to them. And then you're not quite sure whether you've done it enough, so you just put on 5% of effort and do 110%, as it were, in order to make sure that no one can catch you out. And you're still not sure, so you have to do 110% compound interest. And that is the sort of person, perhaps, who has the need to be needy to an excessive degree, who in fact overworks because he can't dare stop working, because it's just possible people don't need his work, and that would be just too awful. And many ministers, many doctors, many other people in caring professions get into that kind of scenario. Any of us who are in a caring situation must get something back from it. But that was another talk when we talked about why are you in the ministry anyway. But it's worth asking yourself, what am I getting out of it? Because sometimes we may be feeding something quite neurotic within ourselves, which makes us compulsive in our work, not able to take an objective stance. Likewise, our parishioners, the people who come to us, patients, whatever they are, may be caught up in the same kind of scene. And the theological student who talked about this, that was one of the most frightening things that he saw. his own need to be needy and to serve, he saw in some of the Christian patients who were in the ward at that time. Okay, what do? We call those personality types. I don't care what kind of personality, introverted personality, obsessional personality, perfectionist personality, sometimes used as swear words against people, but it is a way in which we habitually tick. And if you don't see the way in which you habitually tick, then I'm quite sure your spouses do, or your parents, or your close friends. And maybe a little bit of openness to their realism might help at least adapt to one's personality. And what is the help for that? It is psychotherapy, counselling, which is the whole gamut of interaction with another individual who can bring some insight into the way we function and ways in which we could function more effectively. Right, can we move on to the next? Now here we're dealing with what I call the interpersonal model. In other words, here's the interaction between one person and another, or one person and a group. None of us is an island. We all function in some relation to other people, even if it's to say to other people, get lost, I don't like people. That is an interaction. And some people say, I'm a loner, that's the way I am. And what they do is they present such a hostile face to everybody else that nobody else gets near them. And that confirms the fact that they're loners, and in any case, it's better to be a loner because people don't like them anyway. I liken it to the person who goes around life with a great bottom stuck in the air and say, I don't know what it is, but people always kick me in the bottom. And of course, as people see this bottom in the air, it's a temptation to kick them, which fulfills the expectation, which recapitulates the whole cycle. And there are people who perhaps have a rather poor image of themselves, who don't feel they're likeable. And they're not going to trust anybody unless they're absolutely sure that that's someone who is going to continue with them. So they put on the very worst presentation, tell you how bad they really are, are grumpy, nasty, demanding, and all sorts of things, and if you can take that, then it's just possible they can trust you. And it's just possible they may let you in to see the other bits of themselves, the nice bits which they didn't dare realize or didn't dare talk about. Now, they're often very wounded people. They often are people who have experienced multiple rejections, and I've put there the causative factors, family, social, and cultural learning experiences, and expectations. There are some children who are scapegoated. Here is the unintelligent one, put in all sorts of different ways, no doubt, in the family. That child is certainly not going to go through to higher education, no matter what abilities they think they have. Here is the one who is not as easy as the others. Well, that's the one who is going to make quite sure that they fulfill that expectation. That is part of their identity. Here is the person who perhaps has lost everything that they got close to. Mother died when young. Then granny died. So you don't get close to anybody. I remember my days in Dundee when I lectured in the university department there. There seemed to be an excessive amount of depression in that community. And the rest of the Scottish psychiatrists used to laugh at the way in which the Dundonian psychiatrists used to diagnose depression. And they said they couldn't recognize any other condition. And at the time I was aware that this was quite unjust because these patients were genuinely depressed. And then it struck me what was happening was in Dundee in the 40s and 50s and so on and before that, what happened was that it was granny who brought up the children. The mothers went out to work in the factories, in the mills, in Timex. So granny did the upbringing, but granny died young and left a generation of children who were bereaved of the essential mothering figure, the age of 10, 11, 12, 15, or whatever it was. Fathers were never really involved very much. It's very different in Dundee now, but when I compare that with the community in Bristol, it is not the same. There's a different demography, a different culture, a different way in which people are brought up. And that experience of childhood bereavement is much less in the more affluent southwest of England. And I think here was a society which was pushed in a depressive direction. You remember Molly Weir's, most of you remember Molly Weir, don't you? Who advertised, I think some of her last acts were advertising Flash, wasn't it? Flash, this is what you do in your kitchen floor, it's fine. And she, in fact, in her first volume of her autobiography, Shoes Were for Sundays, I think it was called, spoke of her reaction to her grandmother's death. Mother went out to work, and she used to sleep with Granny, and Granny did everything for her, and at night she used to curry up beside Granny to keep warm, and then Granny died when she was about 8 or 9, somewhere around that. And she describes a childhood depression lasting well over a year at that time. She doesn't call it that, but that is really what it is. And I think that did affect her in other ways subsequently, but she had a basically optimistic actress type of personality who could put on a certain kind of face. There are several literary figures who recount that. The other one, in the Newcastle author, what's her name, who wrote R. Kate?
Crookson,
that's it, Crookson, who wrote R. Kate, which was the story of her own early childhood and of her mother. A very, very sad story, and a lot of interpersonal type of depression and her relationships come out of that to some extent. So, here you are, people who are programmed in a different sort of way, whether the family or a social pathology, and in our society, which has got increasing breakup of families, what happens, it says the children are not affected. That's not true. The children retreat to the only person they know is not going to change, and that is Teddy Bear. And wherever Teddy is, that's where they want to be. And that, of course, was well described by A.A. Milne in his poems about Binker and so on, who some of you may recall. So the child is affected. The child may retreat, appear not to be affected. And Teddy is the only person you can trust and you can talk to. But who knows what we're going to reap out of the too casual breaking up of relationships. Because for every broken relationship which is experienced, it is more difficult to believe in the permanence of any subsequent relationship. Whether that's for the children of a broken relationship, or whether it's from the parties in a broken relationship. Now, I'm not saying that there's no place for separation. Sometimes that has to be. But I think there is something built in there for every broken relationship which is experienced. There will be difficulty in believing the permanence of any subsequent relationship, which makes a person depressed and pessimistic in relation to relationships. And what one sees here is people reacting to certain individuals, particular situations, apparently getting on in their life all right, but certain recurrent situations, often with authority figures, sometimes with regard to work, and sometimes within marriage. And you get the man who, in fact, is a rather dominant character, marries this little mouse of a wife who really wants to have a strong, stable character, and then finds that she's dominated, she is pushed down in this marriage, and as she begins to gain her own gradual emergence of a personality, feels utterly depressed every time her husband then begins to tell her what she should be doing. And that's a very common scenario, which I'll come back to this afternoon, of the unfulfilled marriage, which began with certain expectations and ended up being destructive and depression producing, often because of factors built in to the early expectations of the marriage. Right, what are the treatments? The treatments are family therapy, group therapy, marital therapy. It doesn't matter, but what the person has to be involved in is in some kind of interaction with other people. So that sober assessment, that reality testing in a group situation or a family situation is essential. You need a third party. And you think of the marvelous example of Hannah and Elkanah needed a third party in their marriage. You remember how poor old Hannah used to weep her heart out, and Eli was the only one to spot it. And he said, come on, what's going on, my dear? And she said, oh, I've got a nice husband, and I've got everything I could ever want. I just don't know why I'm so depressed. It's this baby I don't have. And her husband said, well, am I not worth more than all these babies to you? And the fact was, he wasn't. And he found that hard. And she felt very guilty and upset. And Eli had to come in as a third party. Well, okay. Let's move on to the last column. And here I put the existential model. And really, there are people who are depressed in relation to what's life about. What is their philosophy of life? What makes life tick for you is a question which increasingly I have to ask. Here you have a person who says, I've nothing to be depressed about, etc., etc. And all right, they may be profoundly depressed, you get them out of it, then you say, now come on, we've got to chat about this a bit more. What really makes life tick for you? Where is your treasure, if you like? And the commonest answer in a woman is, my children, then her house, and then perhaps her husband last. And for the man, his job, if he's got one, his do-it-yourself or painting his house, his car perhaps, his kids, and wife's, his football club and so on, and then wife, if she comes in at all, is way down the list. So what happens when you're redundant, or you're passed over promotion? What happens when you've decorated your house every year for the past 30 years? What happens when your football team goes bust, or is bottom and relegated into the lower league? What happens when your wife has decided that she finds somebody else more attractive than you, and your children all tell you that you are an absolute bore who was never around when they needed you when they were teenagers? You get depressed. And it's appropriate to say, well, the things you've invested in, they've been bad investments, or at least you haven't looked after your investments. Now, in a sense, this is what the writer to Ecclesiastes talked about some years ago. He tried pleasure. He tried work. And he earned so much money, and he looked at who he was going to leave it to, and said they hadn't even the wit to spend it properly, far less earn it. And he had to look and say, what was life about? Now, I think increasingly people are being forced to that situation. Now, as a psychiatrist, can't tell them what life is about. I can explore with them the areas that they've already invested in and say, now, can we look at other areas with them? And I don't think the minister of the gospel or other carers are immune to this. Doctors have a notorious high incidence of suicide and also of cirrhosis of the liver due to drink. Their wives have a much higher incidence of depression and suicide than other professional men's wives. Why? Because very often work has become the major investment in life for many doctors. And all I can say too is that I see far more parsons' wives than I do see parsons. Ministers up here. Why? Because very often, under the guise of serving the Lord, they're really serving their own egos sometimes. Again, Jim hinted on that point, and I would agree with that entirely. It was Charles Simeon, the great evangelical leader of the 18th century, used to speak of his ministresses, who were the wives of his ministers. And in his equivalent of the Crieff Conference in the years 1810, 1820, he had the wives of his ministers used to come. And they had their own program, and sometimes joined in with the men. And he often said they were by far and away the better halves. Anyway, there you are. He was a doughty bachelor who cared for both his ministers, his ministers and their ministresses. All right. And, well, I put it there you are, because so often what happens here is there is rebellion against God in some measure or another. There is a lack of trust in him. Flesh, the sin and the devil, one way or another, comes in and can cause depression, as Jim was talking to us, as Jim described to us. And it's sometimes because we don't see the fall of man affecting the way in which we carry out our own job of caring. We can see it sometimes for others. And the diagnosis may be pride, ego trips, or whatever other label you like to put on them. And the ministry is not our sustenance. It is whether the word speaks to us too. And whether we allow ourselves to have fellowship and to be cared for. And many ministers certainly stimulate fellowship for other people within the congregation, but not for them. They don't need it. And I remember one man who once said, when I asked him, "Who cares for you?" And he said, "The Lord, I suppose." Well, his wife and family didn't feel that that was the end of it by any manner of means. So there you are. Those are the models, those are the ways of looking at depression. Now, what I want to say to you here is that many Christians are prone to go for the last column there and say, get your prayers right, allow the word to seep into your mind, be attached to a fellowship and so on, and then all these things will be taken care of. And I think that is to do despite to the way God has created us. He has created us as body, mind, in relationship to others, as well as spirit. And if we reduce ourselves and other people to just that spiritual element, then we negate that person in some way. Now, there are those people who would see people only in the organic model. Get the biochemistry right and everything will go all right. There's the antidepressants, bye-bye. But in so doing, they're denying the humanity of that individual. It is still possible for a psychiatrist to see an individual without asking to see the husband or wife. I hope nobody in my particular clinical team would ever dare to continue that way, but it does seem to happen, which is tragic. Likewise, there's the sort of psychiatrist model, the organic one, and I would say the bad psychiatrist model. When we come to the intrapsychic model, that's the sort of behavioral psychologist. That's the counselor, the person who wants to see a person on the one-to-one. What do you feel? What are your attitudes? What are your reactions? And whether it's psychotherapy of an analytic nature or whether it's psychotherapy of a behavioral nature. Whether it's counselling with this kind of counselling or that kind of counselling or the other 57 different varieties of counselling, doesn't matter. If that is what one's doing, one is reducing the person to merely discussing attitudes. Now, you may be more skilled in that than in the other areas, but beware that we don't push a person into just that model. Likewise, we come to the interpersonal model. Here's the social worker, the group therapist, the relate worker, who refuse to see people except in groups, who refuse to see anyone except as family units. In other words, they're seeing a person merely as an interacting organism rather than a person in their own right. And I would plead with whoever is in a helping situation, by all means, to see what their own special expertise is, but you must cast an eye over whichever particular column you feel you're an expert in. And see, perhaps, there are others more skilled in other areas. I, as a psychiatrist, can give pills and potions. I do look at people's attitudes. I do see their spouses and their families. I do explore the area of what life is about with them. But one has to sort these things out for oneself in one's own situation. Right, let me move on to the next slide. Here, what I've done is I've tried to sort of put up three cardboard men or women. The pastor, the counselor, the psychiatrist. The carer, the counselor, or the treater. Now, these are not mutually exclusive categories. As a psychiatrist in the community where I am, I do have to give counsel to other people, and I'm also involved as someone active in ministry within the local parish church. So in fact, I may be involved with one person in three different ways. So you can't put your life into those nice, tight compartments. At least I can't. Many psychiatrists say they can't be involved in any other activity within the community. I think it's hard to be involved, but it's something which you've got to work at. And I maybe said last time I was here that when I was being a bit huffy about this, the minister of the church which I go to said, "Monty, even the witch doctor has to be a member of the fellowship." And that's fair. So, okay, it is harder, but you've got to work at it. Likewise, the counsellor in a counselling role, you cannot take over the role of medic. But that doesn't mean you can't see medical issues and encourage the person to seek help there. And as a pastor or carer, whatever role you have there, there is something different which you offer, which doesn't mean that you will not be doing counselling, and likewise able to spot areas which should be referred to a doctor. Now, what is the interaction there? And what are the dangers of trying to move out of your particular area into other people's? Well, let's begin with the latter first. The dangers of moving out are these. That I, as a psychiatrist, I'm also a doctor. And as a doctor, there are certain things I can do that nobody else can do. And that is, if somebody has got a sore tummy as well as feeling depressed, I can say, take off your clothes, lie up on that plinth, I want to examine your abdomen. Now, if you did that to anyone, you would in fact be guilty of common assault. I have a parchment which allows me to do that in certain situations, in the consulting room or hospital only, not in the vestry or in my home or someplace else. That's important. You may feel that's facetious. It is not. There are boundaries around that. And the more responsibility we carry in certain areas, the more careful we have to be that we keep to the appropriate boundaries for that. A person is sent to me for a prescription. He's got an illness, and to persuade him he hasn't got an illness may be very difficult. He's decided he's ill, his GP's decided he's ill, and then he comes to me with a double expectation of being ill, and when I tell him he's not, it may take a while. And what do I bring? I bring techniques and resources. When a person needs help, inpatient treatment of one sort or another, caring, I ring up the ward and say, "Sister, here's a person who is depressed, and know that I've got two shifts of nurses to look after that person." And my task is to relieve suffering and restore function. Now the counsellor, the person goes and enters into a contract. Maybe I've got something to offer, maybe you've got something that you want to share with me. Let's see how it goes. The person is not a patient, but a client, and I object to the common language, now coming into certain aspects of psychiatry, where patients are no longer patients, but clients. That is the language of counselling and not of medicine, and it obscures something fundamental in the way in which we care for people. Clients come in and opt in or opt out, and you likewise, as a counsellor, can say, "Nothing to offer, try somebody else." Or say, "Yes, here we go, let's try it for five sessions," or whatever. They may bring experience and skill, but the counselling movement is aimed at happiness and achieving potential, which is essentially a humanist gloss. And Carl Rogers, who in a sense was responsible for the counselling movement, remember was a theological student who eventually decided not to go on with the ministry and became a psychologist, and many of his counselling approaches and many of his tea groups and so on do seem to me to be derived from his Christian background, especially his New England Puritan background, gutted of the spiritual components and given a humanist framework. Now that doesn't mean they're wrong. He's perfectly entitled to look at human nature and say that's the way people take. Here are things which we can help with. And they do help. But it has sometimes within it a hidden agenda according to the philosophy underlying the particular type of counselling. And then the pastor. If it's someone who is a member of your congregation, that person belongs to you. They're a member of the body along with you. It's not a person who is sent, it's not a person with problems necessary, not a patient with illness. Here's a member of the body, as you are a member of the body. And what is your aim and goal? It is to present men and women mature in Christ Jesus. And the level at which they will mature may be very different and a very different rate from other people. Some people mature quickly. Some people mature with hiccups. Some people mature very fast. And that may depend on a whole series of factors to do with their upbringing, to do with their personalities and so on. And I'm talking of their spiritual maturity, not just the psychological maturity. And there are many people who have real problems, if you like, within their lives, who say, well, look, there is my life. That's the way it is. Now, where do I go from here? And they may be far, far more mature persons in spiritual terms than many other individuals to whom life has been extremely kind, even bountiful in the gifts which they've inherited or acquired. Well, there you are. There's the framework. And if you transgress into the other, say, for instance, as a pastor, you wish to become more of a counselor, then what you will do is you will, in fact, acquire the panoply of the counselor. You'll have the interview room, the desk, and the diplomas on the walls. You will lose that ability to relate and to befriend. I've just come back from the States, and a friend was visiting, and I went up to his church, and there he had the entrance foyer, and there was the secretary's office, and you had to get through her office before you could get to his office, which was behind. And I think she was every bit of as dragon as the GP's secretary. She protected him. I'm not saying that's wrong. But you went into his office, and here was the chair opposite, in the right counselling position, and there were all the diplomas and degrees on the wall. And I thought, you know, this is not very dissimilar from the psychiatrist's room, except I don't put my diplomas on the wall. Do you see the point I'm making? There's a shift in that direction. And insofar as a shift in that direction, which is not wrong in itself, it may deprive you of the ability to befriend. Now, some people may have greater skills there, but I was always struck by the comment that the schools of pastoral psychology in the States were full, those of pastoral theology were half empty. Now, beware. And the more you feel you have a healing ministry, and you're moving more into the realm of the psychiatrist, the more you may find that you are in fact restricted in a way which wouldn't be yours if you were more content to be a pastor who had some understanding of these other issues. And each one must decide for himself. But that is one of the dangers I see of incorporating counselling programs within churches, having special counsellors within churches. Because if you're special counsellors, they cease to be members of the body in the same sort of way. And we had this great debate in our own church about setting up counsellors, specialist counsellors. And what won the day really was, if you have special counsellors, what will happen is that the fellowship will begin to say, over to the specialist counsellor, rather than caring for the individual concerned. And who's going to look after those specialist counsellors anyway? And they become an elite, a hierarchy, and eventually, of course, they pay, they demand payment for their skills as well. Now, that's not wrong. It's useful to make people look at what things cost, but is that really what you wish to incorporate? And I remember one of the church leaders who was a lawyer said, look, I'd rather be friends within my congregation rather than be a specialist counsellor. And what we did was we did have our courses on counselling. We did have our courses on ways in which we can help each other. But we made it open to the whole congregation, so all the neurotics could come as well as those who were carers. And hopefully the neurotics learned a bit about themselves. Which was helpful. Why shouldn't they? It didn't make a hierarchy, it just made the whole congregation aware of helping each other. And some would become more skilled. Some of you know my wife, Rosemary, who is a French graduate, nothing to do with medicine whatsoever. I often tease her and say she was my insurance against marrying a nurse when I became a houseman. But when she heard me talking about this, she used to say, you know, you don't give very much to the counsellor. And I said, well, what more would you like than you already have? And when she thought about it, she said, no, I'd rather just be Rosemary Barker, who has no special expertise here, who can deal with people at a level which I know I can deal with them, in friendship, in warmth, and in caring, with a few tricks of the trade, you know, up my sleeve because I'm married to a psychiatrist. And we have a sticker in our kitchen, given us by somebody actually, which says, thank you for listening to my problems. I couldn't afford a psychiatrist. Right. One or two last little things, and then we will stop for some questions. Two graphs. Some of you may have seen this before, but it makes a point that if you take the red lines and the green lines, the red lines indicate people who were randomly allocated to a group in which their discomforts and their aches and their pains and their anxieties were dealt with. In other words, they came to the psychiatrist and the psychiatrist said, yes, you've got various kinds of anxiety, depression, somatic complaints and so on. I want you to go into a group. In other words, you'll be seen along with 10 other people on a weekly basis. And then the other people were just as randomly allocated to, yes, you'll be attached to Dr. X or Nurse Y or Student Z, in other words, a therapist. And they'll be seen on a one-to-one basis over a period of several months and year, a couple of years. If you take the left-hand graph there, people seen in groups, what happens is, with people seen in groups underneath it, the people who were seen on a one-to-one basis felt better much more quickly than the people who were seen in groups. You felt better if you saw somebody on your own week after week. It made you feel good. But if you looked at how they functioned, the people who were seen in groups began to function better insofar as they began to take on things in life which they'd ceased to be able to do. They could again begin to do visits, they'd face people, go into social situations, etc., which they'd withdrawn from. They didn't feel better, but they functioned better. Now that is an important point. The more you see yourself in a one-to-one counselling, pastoring ministry, the greater is your danger of producing pastor addiction. Because people will feel good and they want more of it. And when you begin to say, now we've had long enough, they'll kick, they'll squeal, they'll grunt, they'll go to all sorts of subterfuges to make sure that they see you again next week and not in 3 weeks' time or whatever. They'll start ringing you up. Oh, I'm feeling terrible. I'm suicidal. I'm awful. And they'll up the stakes, and you feel hooked again into the one-to-one. So unless you're very skilled at it, there's a grave danger in which you, in fact, get hooked into seeing them that way. They feel better. They don't necessarily function better. Whereas if, in fact, they are encouraged to be involved with another group of people at some level or another, then their behaviour is more likely to change. Now, these timescales are over a period of 2 years. Nothing magic in this. And I can think of one lady who went to one of our house groups for studying the Bible and praying together. She was a professional lady. She was a doctor, actually. Middle-aged. And she said nothing for 2 years. 3 years, actually. And I felt I was a dreadful house group leader. I couldn't make her read the Bible, pray, or anything. She'd help with the washing up afterwards. And then at the end of 3 years, she wrote me a letter saying, and this is what's been happening during those 3 years. She now prays and reads with other people and, in fact, takes a much more active situation. She was really quite profoundly depressed at one level. She did have to go on antidepressants. But once the antidepressants began to work, she then had to look at the other areas of her life. And the sort of terrible pessimism which she had about herself, a very difficult marriage, and the fact that she had slipped spiritually over many years, all had to be dealt with as well. So it wasn't just the pills. It wasn't just the sort of dealing with her at an individual level. It was also dealing with her at a group level without specifically attacking her particular problems. And the word did its own work. In the company of the fellowship of other people. Don't despise that. Now, obviously, I earn my living from dealing with people who are ill, and there are other people who earn their living from dealing with people who are ill on a counselling level and so on. I don't wish to minimise that. I'm just saying, be careful you don't squander your own heritage. Be careful if you go into those territories that you're not actually losing something, which in the long run may be more valuable. And then lastly, could you slip the paper down? We did start late, didn't we?
Yep.
Well, ministers are long-winded, psychiatrists are worse. What are the ingredients and prerequisites of healing, irrespective of the healing? And there they are: the personality of the healer, a designated location, an accepted rationale, and a prescribed procedure. And irrespective of whether that's an operative procedure, in other words, let's chop your leg off there, or let's sit down and chat about it, those are the commodities which are there to a greater or lesser extent. The personality of the healer, very briefly. The person who was warm, empathic, and accepting. There is the ideal healer. And you feel better as soon as you hear somebody being described as warm, empathic, and accepting. I mean, immediately you feel better, don't you? Just the kind of person you'd like to talk to. But if that warmth can't be kept up, then it's damaging. And there are many people who give a lot of warmth on first meeting people. And when they don't get better, or they don't respond to their particular form of pastoral counselling, or their particular form of therapy, or their particular pills, then the warmth begins to get a little bit scarcer. And the classical one in medicine is, thank you for referring this delightful, intelligent young woman. I'm sure we'll be able to help her bellyache. 3 weeks later, she comes back. This young woman came again to see me in my clinic. 3 weeks later. Your patient attended again. 3 weeks later. This dreadful hypochondriac. It's an actual case. And that woman felt angry, bitter, and furious. And now they send me to a shrink, was her first comments to me. Now I had to undo all that. Don't offer more warmth than you can sustain. You can always up the stakes later. But if you put on the forced grin and the enthusiasm, this is what you need. Now that goes specially for the forms of counselling you've got. If you've got a special counselling, it's a surefire way of healing everybody's problems, whatever it is. We have this new form of healing which we've just found, which has crossed the Atlantic recently, and big beams on your face and so on. You will have a group of very, very disillusioned, very bitter, and very angry, and rightly angry people. It doesn't mean that that form of counselling is not helpful. Be careful how you sell it. Warmth, which is consistent. Acceptance, yes, but we all set limits. And we'll talk about that in the second session. We must know where we set limits. And some of us may set limits way down the line and others are way up the line, according to our own temperance. And also when it comes to empathy, it is far, far more important to be honest and say, I don't fully understand. I dealt with many bereaved patients before I ever had a bereavement myself. We may understand in part, but far better to be honest. And then the designated location. Well, in a sense, I touched on that when I said, when I ask somebody to undress, I do it in a specific location. Be careful that you don't take techniques, approaches, into inappropriate situations. And people, in fact, who engage in various psychological therapies and so on, where a lot of touch and other things like that are used, I think, and grave danger sometimes, of unleashing things in an inappropriate situation. You need to have a place where it's possible. And the Roman Catholics quite rightly say, if you are going to expose all this material to another man, then there's a grill between you and that person. And there's a structure within which it occurs. There is a location in space and in time where it happens. And I've recently had to deal with a Christian in grave distress because he had gone to his minister, and the minister said, well, let's have it. Let's have exactly what is going on. I want the truth, the whole truth. And this person told about the truth, and immediately this pastor started then going around other members of the congregation, asking for confirmatory evidence, and before we knew where they were, the police were involved and so on. That could never have happened in the Roman Catholic Church. And there is greater honour there, and experience in dealing with this, than in many groups who offer to counsel and then do not know how to keep the counsel appropriate. And then we come to the accepted rationale. There must be an understanding between the person who is being helped and us who are helping as to why it's going on. What's it all about? Why are we doing this? People who come to me with a pain in the belly and I say, well, what we need to do is chat. Maybe very, very cross. People who come profoundly depressed with all sorts of emotions and I say, there's a pill, or I want you to have electric treatment, may also be very cross. I've got to somehow or other bridge the gap to say, this is what it's about. And you in your preaching, and in your teaching, and in your counselling, and your pastoring, must enable people to see, look, this is what it's about. When we talk about this in the scriptures, or whatever it is, this is what it means in terms of the way you live, and the way you have your particular problem. But you know, that's the most difficult thing of all, to transfer our expertise and our understanding of what we're doing to the person to whom we're speaking or dealing, with whom we're dealing. I remember a surgeon who came in, and he was a person with a tiny little bit of black in his toe. And he said, right, we'll have your leg off there. And he did sort of mid-calf. And the poor chap was absolutely shattered. All he had was a little bit of black in his toe. And when he woke up, in fact, he had a mid-thigh amputation there instead. Well, it made good sense from the doctor's point of view. The arteries were that diseased, and the black indicated something absolutely horrific going on inside his arteries. But he hadn't communicated to the patient what was going on. Therefore, that patient required special help subsequently. Now, you may be sure that the medicine you're giving from the pulpit, that you're giving in the pastoral counseling, is exactly what they need. But unless they can see the appropriateness of that, unless it begins to touch them, where they really feel the pain of their life, then maybe it is just empty words, even though you felt you were filled with spirit and an unction in your preaching. I sit under ministers and have done for many years. Occasionally I subject other people to my preaching. But I never forget my wife in the early days. I would prepare a sermon and I'd sort of go over it with her, and she said, that's very interesting. So what? And I have to ask myself, so what? What difference does that actually make? And unless the person there can see the what, then you haven't actually entered into this other aspect, whether it's physical, spiritual, or psychological healing. And then lastly, the prescribed ritual. I need to send my patients away with something which they do that makes them feel, yes, I can see, I can take responsibility for this. I know that here is something I can do. And if they're purely passive, say, that was a very interesting session, doctor, see you next week, next month, whatever it is, and have done no homework during the next few weeks, I've got nowhere with them. And likewise, I would suggest, whatever form of helping, whether it's from the pulpit, whether it's in your vestry, whether it's visiting them, whether it is counselling, unless there is something which they can see, this is something which I then must do. Have you really gone into that healing of the broadest nature? Right, there we are. Time up. Sorry, I've taken you. Have lunch, actually.
To ask you about the four columns that you put, and you said that if you're a pastor, you need to be careful that you don't go into the counsellor model, that you actually ought to, and you told the story of the American and the some of the problems that some of us have as pastors is that people who are often very busy, people feel that they can have 2 hours with us over coffee, and they want to stretch it on and on, and unless you provide go into a different model, seeing them in an office with a secretary, it actually puts you under great pressure. Could you comment on that?
Well, did you all get that question? That's true. And so what you do is you have the secretary in the office as a way of bolstering your ability to say you have only got an hour. but you may be taking in something else with that package. And why not, in the first place, say, yes, I'm happy to see you, I have an hour, half an hour, whatever it is. Why can't you say that right at the start? I tell my patients how long they've got. I say, look, I need an hour to discuss this. Or, look, it's only half an hour, and they look at me, I think I need more than that. I say, well, look, sorry, half an hour, I think, is all we've got next time.
I think that's easier for you as a doctor.
I accept that, but I think you have got to be able to put your limits as well over. At the end of the day, the patients will... Patients in my context, and parishioners and so on in your context, will thank you, because you'll have more time to give to more people, and probably far more effective. Now, you may decide 2 hours first time round. And then say, now, look, I think half an hour next time I see you will be enough. You don't allow yourself to be pursued in this way. Now, you can use all sorts of subterfuges to get somebody to ring the front doorbell and say, oh, that's my next visitor. I've seen some do that. Or you get your wife to come in and say, somebody on the phone dear. Oh, that's the call I've been waiting for the last half day. Or you can have your office. There are various ways in which you can do it. But each one carries with it something extra. Do you really want to take that on? The half lie? Or the professionalism? It was Paul Tournier, the psychiatrist, who, in fact, who used to see people in his front room, in his living room. Deliberately. I don't. I couldn't cope with that. My family life has to go on. Therefore, I have an outpatient clinic or a private consulting room. Now, I cannot say that you mustn't do what you just said is necessary, by all means. But are you looking at the implications of why you're doing that? Could it be done otherwise? And what else are you bringing into the situation by doing that? That's really all I want to say.
May I make a comment on that, Monty? On the very first meeting of our grief group in Sandy Tate's Mads was to hear Jeff Dixon speak on this matter before he went to Australia. And this was his point. You must learn to be more clinical.
I don't like the word more clinical. I would say, no, deliberately, because it refers to something. I know exactly what he meant. You must learn to be more precise with the people you're dealing with and set the limits. And that's what clinicians do, and I think that's what pastors have to do.
Right. Come over here.
Could I ask a question, please, about the groups? If you are saying that people are helped with depression in groups, if within a pastoral situation somebody comes with depression, are you suggesting setting up groups to help them in particular, or are there particular sorts of groups you would suggest that we introduce them to?
Well, our particular way of dealing with it is through house groups, where we've got maybe about 50 to 60 house groups with about 10 people in each meet on a weekly basis. We have several weeks all in a row and then a break for Christmas and various other things like that, where we study the same passage of scripture together with notes, we pray together as groups. We also have our large prayer meeting as well, or larger prayer meeting, but far more people meet to study the word together and to pray together in that way than would if you had just a weekly meeting. Now, I know there are divergences of opinion on this, but that's the way we do it. And what we find that within those groups, in a large church, there's a lot more caring can go on, not specifically for depressed people, but for everybody. I mean, my wife, as some of you know, has had 2 serious illnesses in the last 2 years. The amount of caring and just sheer practical support given by the house group was quite overwhelming. They enabled me to function as a professional person at a time when she was in hospital over a prolonged period of time. Now, they gave back to me what they felt they were getting in other ways. We've had one or two rather depressed people. Not really depressed people. I think they kill a group. But this woman who didn't speak for 3 years was really quite depressed. But we didn't treat her depression. We accepted it as her. We refused to go into her depression. We refused to get involved with all the bits and pieces, and she didn't want that. She was having other people to help there. What she appreciated was the ability to come and learn from the Word, to relate to other people in a situation which was not demanding, where all sorts of other things were being dealt with, in listening, in being befriended. And she, in fact, said that was what really helped her depression, after the pills had done their work. Now, that's incidental. Marriages, we've had a couple of people whose marriages almost broke up. It was the group, or one or two people within the fellowship group, who actually did the major part of caring. Now, you can't manufacture that. That's something which has to grow up slowly. I do believe that that is a very powerful way of caring for each other. I was an historian before I was a medical student, and my first published paper is in the Praying Societies of 18th century Scotland. And I was impressed by the caring, teaching, and praying that went on in the 18th century prayer groups, which in fact have a heritage back to the 16th century. It was the evangelical ministers of the turn of the into the 19th century who killed that by demanding that everything came under the aegis of the minister. They were so terrified of sectarianism and so on. And yet those groups spawned the revival to some extent of Whitfield and Wesley, and also the 39 revival. It was after that the minister said, no, we don't like these groups, and you come into the church. Now, I've written that elsewhere. I'm merely quoting what I put on paper.
Last question.
Could I ask about the statistic you gave at the very beginning, that 50% of depressed people who reach hospital care will have no further depression?
No, I said 50% of severe depressed patients will not have a subsequent depression. Yes.
I'm wondering if that's a bit optimistic from experience in general practice, where perhaps many of these people come back at that level, recognize, and their GP recognizes an early stage, and intervenes earlier, and so the frank depression might reach you again, doesn't that happen?
Well, I would take that figure actually from 20 odd years ago, before GPs were very good at putting people on the antidepressants. So it may be that what I'm really quoting is the very severe depressions before, you know, a lot of people put up with depression in the past and just got on with it, and or didn't get on with it for 2 years and so on. I'm really thinking of the very severe depressions rather than the person who struggles through a depression maybe for 2 years without too much help one way or another. So that, yes, as we become more aware of depression, it may not be as optimistic a figure as that, but I wonder, there's nothing really. Let me put it this way. The admissions to psychiatric hospitals for severe psychosis are no different today from what they were 100 years ago. So the severe forms of illness have not changed. The amount of lesser illness of one sort or another, which in fact we can help, has increased enormously. And I agree with Jim again when he says, you know, when the older say, oh, it wasn't like that in our day. I think the pressures upon people today are far, far greater. It's a feature of rough affluence, of choice, but also of other factors. So, yes, things have changed, but not for the very severe.
I say grace now. Thank you.